Hurricane Dorian did more than damage structures in the Bahamas. It damaged the environment. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There are places that may not have access to potable water for a long time. WLRN's Danny Rivero recently traveled to the Bahamas to examine the toll from Hurricane Dorian many months later. Also, we meet Olivier Picasso, the grandson of the famous 20th century painter. He's hosting a special auction in Miami where $109 might get you a million-dollar Picasso painting. Finally.
And they made it sound like being a lesbian or being gay was part of the crime. And I was a closeted queer kid growing up in Miami Beach.
Puerto Rican author Jaquita Diaz grew up in the South Beach of the 1980s and early 90s. Her memoir, Ordinary Girls, looks at how the city shaped her views of family, love, and self-identity. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. 6 months after Hurricane Dorian, the only fresh drinking water available in Grand Bahama is coming from relief groups. The Category 5 storm contaminated the drinking supply with salt water. Scientists have warned this same thing could happen in South Florida. WLRN's Danny Rivero took a trip last week to Grand Bahama to examine the long-term impacts that saltwater intrusion is having on the island. So, Danny, paint a picture of how different things looked when you landed in Freeport compared to some of the more rural areas of Grand Bahama.
So, Freeport is the largest city or the largest settlement on the island, and it's the economic capital. They have cruise ships coming in there all the time. And in the town of Freeport, basically all the debris was cleared, the streets were cleared. You still see some houses in different states of disrepair, but it didn't look recent. It looked like it had been addressed in some way or another. And when you drive out to the far east end of the island, it's about a 50-mile drive to get all the way over to the other side. You see houses just level to the ground. There's bulldozers that are knocking houses down that were too messed up to really fix. You see people sleeping in their tents. There's no electricity still. There's no running water. So the far east ends of the island are really still feeling the immediate impacts of the storm.
You spoke with Remington Wilstrom, the manager of engineering at Grand Bahama Utility Company, which oversees the electricity and water on the island, and he explained just how severe the damage was from Dorian.
It didn't just impact some of the wells. It impacted all the wells and our plants. Three of our four plants went underwater. One of them, which is our major one, which supplied 60% of the island, actually went underwater. So the impact there was a total destruction.
So what did he tell you that the process has been for getting potable drinking water and electricity back to those remote parts of the island?
So in the immediate term, the government and the company have really been relying on relief work to get people drinking water in the short term. In the long term, they're trying to do what they call repair some of these aquifers that were damaged. And that means they're pumping out a lot of the salt water in hopes that that when it starts raining again, that the rainwater will come down and that it'll kind of repair it. And they've also been drilling new wells on the very highest points of the island. You know, the island's only 40 feet tall at its highest points. The storm surge was 30 feet. So they drilled some new wells on the very highest points of the island, and they said, thank God they found some fresh water in those new wells that they were never tapping before.
You also spoke with families that are living this new normal. Tell us about Amanda Kellowin and what she's going through.
So Amanda's family lost their entire home. They lived in Freeport. I met them just a couple days after the storm hit, and there was really nothing left. There was just, how I put it in the story, just miscellanea laying around. It was all soggy. And they lived with family friends for about 4 months. Just very recently, they got an apartment on their own while they wait for insurance money. They're not sure when it's going to come in. And life has been hard. You know, they're struggling every day. I mean, they're happy that they finally have a place to call their own right now. But they are struggling through this process.
Did you speak with anyone who has family in South Florida? And if maybe they're trying to migrate here?
I will say, you know, considering how close the Bahamas are, and especially Grand Bahama, and the fact that we have ferries going every day there, almost everyone you talk to has, you know, a daughter here going to school, a cousin that lives here. And the communities are very, very close. I just mentioned Amanda Kellowin. She's trying to get a visa to come here just to do shopping because they lost everything in the storm, her family. And then, you know, a lot of people just come and do shopping here. Well, she's actually an immigrant from Guyana, and it's very difficult for her to get a visa to come here just to do shopping. But that's what a lot of people are doing. They're going back and forth lugging products.
And what's the process like if they're seeking something like temporary protected status?
So this was something that was discussed just after the storm when the impacts were really being noticed for the first time when cameras got out there. But the federal government has not given Bahamian residents access to temporary protected status. It's something that was brought up, like I said, but the White House ultimately opted not to give Bahamians that option.
I'm speaking with WLRN's Danny Rivero. He took a trip last week to Grand Bahama to examine the toll of the damage done by Hurricane Dorian 6 months ago. Now, you can listen to Danny's full story on our website at WLRN.org, and you can see photos from the reporting trip. So, Danny, beyond the damage done to the water tables and electricity infrastructure, there was a lot of ecological damage, specifically to the pine forest. What have researchers told you about the long-term impacts of that damage?
So the pine forest question is it's a really hard thing to see because, like I mentioned, the drive from Freeport to the east end of the island is about 50 miles. And for virtually the entire stretch of road that you're driving on both sides of the road, you just see dead pine forest. In some cases, it's as far as your eye can even take you. And the forests have been decimated. You know, I did talk to some researchers that said, look, this is a very bad sign for the future of the drinking water on Grand Bahama Island, because under those pine forests were their aquifers. And those pine forests have given space for the aquifers to fill back up with the rain. And, you know, it's not a good sign for anything when the trees are all dead. And it signifies that the water under it is virtually all salty. And this is where they got a lot of their drinking water from, ever since up until this point.
And you did mention that, you know, I mean, our geography here is similar to the Bahamas. And so, you know, we see what's happening with their issues with the forest and their drinking water compared to what we have here in place of Miami-Dade and Monroe counties. I mean, what's the current status of our drinking wells, you know, when you keep in mind that idea of saltwater intrusion?
Well, there's interesting models you could pull up online from the federal government. And, you know, if you look at Miami-Dade County in particular, you can actually look at it year after year. Our drinking wells used to be a lot closer to Biscayne Bay. And over the last couple of years, they've been moving further and further west because they keep getting too salty to drink. So now the bulk of our water is coming from wells that are all the way out near the Florida Turnpike, you know, in western Miami-Dade County. And in some worst case scenario models, if we get hit by a similar storm, like something like Dorian, you know, the models even show that those wells could be flooded by salt water that comes in through the canals and the rivers that we have. And it just makes its way all the way to the west. And in Broward County in particular, a lot of the municipalities up there have their own drinking water systems inside their municipalities. And a lot of those are much closer to the shoreline. So they could be at higher risk for the kind of flooding that we saw in the Bahamas for Hurricane Dorian.
So after the storm, the Grand Bahama Utility Company brought in hydrologists and scientists to assess what damage was done to the water system. Here again is Remington Mushkam.
We brought in scientists and hydrologists to actually help us with assessing what the damages was. And what they found was the entire water table was destroyed by this act of God.
So if the entire water table is destroyed, Danny, does that essentially mean they have to start from scratch?
It means infrastructure-wise, they do have to start from scratch. You know, they had a lot of their, like you mentioned earlier, all their plants, their machinery went underwater. The wells that they were using were all destroyed. So they've had to start from scratch getting new machinery, they basically had to drill new wells in places that they've never drilled before because they were always like the backup plan. You know, these were the plan Zs. And they have had to go straight to the very highest points of the island and drill those wells. And now that they've found a little bit of fresh water, they've given themselves a deadline of sometime in May when they hope to get that new drinking water online and into people's taps.
In your conversations with Mr. Wilschkamp and other individuals involved in the recovery efforts, I wanted to get a sense of what you're feeling from, you know, how they're doing. Do you get a sense that they want to stay there and rebuild, or that they're just fatigued by all this and they want to get out?
I would say talking to people in the island, it was a little bit of both. You know, you had people that are very resilient, very strong, very proud Bahamians, and they've been through many, many, many storms in the past. And there's a sense from a lot of people that we're going to stick this out. I'm not going anywhere. But then you talk to some other people, and, you know, in the village of Pelican Point on the east side of the island, which was devastated, you know, I did talk to a man who said, look, you know, I've been here my entire life. This man is in his mid-60s. He said, if we get another storm this year, I'm out of here. Like, I need to go to Florida. I need to do something, because there's no way that I can withstand another Dorian scale thing happening to us here on the island.
So, Danny, I have you, and I can't let you go without asking you. I'm going to switch topics here a little bit. Here in South Florida, you know, the discussion isn't so much about hurricanes. It's about coronavirus. And you were at the Miami Beach Convention Center yesterday. What did you hear from Miami Beach officials on this?
Right. It's a different kind of disaster. But the Miami Beach officials basically talked to people in the tourism industry, leaders in it, and they said, look, we're monitoring the situation. Here's where we stand as a city. And basically, the city is open for business. They're not shutting anything down. They're not telling people not to come here. The CDC hasn't told people not to come here. We're still expecting a lot of visitors coming in, people that were planning to go to Ultra Music Festival. The festival was canceled by the city of Miami, but a lot of those people kept their bookings. So they're still going to be coming. And the city of Miami Beach is still happening. They're still partying and going on the water.
And Miami-Dade County commissioners are holding a special session now on the coronavirus. What are they monitoring?
So they're monitoring the State Department of Health, what the CDC is saying, and just they have ears open for any more information. All the residents are open for more information. You know, we've had several cases now in Broward County, just to the north of us, and we're waiting to see if there's any presumptive positives here in Miami-Dade County. That's a big concern for a lot of people. And no, it's just a little bit of a wait and see. And let's listen to what the health experts say.
Danny, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
And again, that's WLRN's Danny Rivero. You can read his full story at WLRN.org. And to give a quick news update, Broward County now has declared a state of emergency after a fourth confirmed coronavirus case. Here in Miami-Dade, Mayor Carlos Jimenez will be traveling to Washington, D.C. tomorrow to meet with the White House and Cruise executives. We will have more updates on COVID-19 online and during All Things Considered this afternoon. Well, still to come, we're going to meet the grandson of the legendary Pablo Picasso. He's in Miami for a charity raffle of one of his grandfather's works. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. What if I told you there's a raffle coming up, and for $109, you can enter to win a piece of art? I know what you're saying. It depends on what art you're talking about. Okay, what if I told you that you could win a Picasso worth $1 million? Now that's an interesting raffle. It's being put on to benefit the charity Care International. That's a group that helps provide access to clean water for 200,000 people throughout Africa. Now you can see the piece that's actually up for raffle by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Joining me now is filmmaker, actor, author Olivier Picasso, the grandson of the famous 20th century artist. Mr. Picasso, such a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Thank you for the invitation.
This isn't the first time that you've had a raffle to piece off, you know, one of the works from your grandfather for charity. You did it in 2013, right?
Yes, it was the first edition. It was a test, but it was a successful moment, especially for an American winner who was totally astonished by the fact that by getting one ticket, he got a big painting.
This is being put on by, it's the Paris-based nonprofit Help Others, who's hosting the auction, I believe.
Yeah, in 2013. You know, for every edition, there is a choice to help, to support a charity organization. And this year, it would be the CARE International organization, which is extremely powerful to provide water in Africa.
Thank you for clarifying that. So how does this raffle work then? What because... I mean, again, for $109, I could get a Picasso painting.
Yeah, in fact, there is a double chance, first, to win a painting, and second, to help a very nice organization to provide help to people. So it's very simple, very no risk to get any virus. The only thing you can get is a painting. There is a website. It's onepicasso100euros.com, because originally it's in euros. Well, ticket is 100 euros, $109. And it's a secured website where you can buy with a total confidence one or more tickets. And the raffle will take place on the 30th of March in Paris under the supervision of a legal authority. So everything is clear.
So the piece that's up for the raffle is the 1921 painting titled Nature Mort. How do you say this? I want to make sure.
Still Life.
Still Life. Thank you. Okay. All right. I was trying to say the French way. All right.
Nature Morte.
Okay. Thank you. This is an oil on canvas depiction. It's of a newspaper alongside a glass of absinthe. But
yes.
You describe it for me better.
Yeah, it's an interesting painting because it's strictly the Cubist period of my grandfather, and this is the masterpiece. Let's say the paramount of his exploration of Cubism is what we call the synthetic Cubism, and it's a representation of a cafe in Paris where you can have a newspaper. A glass, a table, and it's a signed painting. It belongs to a very famous collector who has accepted to sell it for a good price. And it's something which has real value, not only about the price, but about the expertise about Pablo Picasso. It's something which is important in both ways.
Now, there will be 200,000 raffle tickets sold for this. A lot of money that will be raised. And again, as I said, it's to help people throughout parts of Africa to get clean water. But if you could tell me a little bit more about the charity and what they're doing.
It's a worldwide organization, and they are specialized in providing water in villages and schools in Africa. And they are helping women, mostly. And it's really something which is very, very organized, very strict. And you can even go on internet and have a look at CARE. It's a big moment for us to support this raffle because we are sure that the money will help really people in this area of the world.
Now, you actually live here in Miami Beach part of the year. You've moved here just a couple of years ago. You bought a place.
Yeah, about 2 years ago, I made a decision to have a hub here in America, which is extremely convenient. I like the American organization, and I love the Latino spirit of Miami, so it's a good combination. For me, it's a kind of reminder of my grandfather, in fact.
You know what? That's interesting, because, I mean, so you live in Paris.
Yes.
But why Miami? Miami, especially Miami Beach, of all the places in the United States you can live, and what is that link to you? Why does it remind you of your grandfather?
Oh, first, it's a warm place in winter. You know, in Europe, in Paris especially, it's cold and dark and humid and and really not a charming place. Paris is wonderful in springtime, in summertime, in fall, but in winter, I wanted to find a place which is, I'm an urban person. I like to have a view. I like to go to museums, to go to a basketball match, to go shopping, and to visit the beaches all around here. And Miami, it's perfect. It has changed a lot over the 20 past years, and I'm very happy to arrive here. Now I feel like a second home. It's really a magical place. And from Miami, you can go to the Caribbean, to Mexico, to Los Angeles, to New York very easily. And I think it's one of a kind.
And the other thing, too, is this. As you know, this is a growing art market as well.
Oh, yes. Not only... My first time was about 20 years ago in Miami, before Art Basel Miami, which has been now one of the major... place in the world for a fair. And not only, but the Bass Museum, the Perez Museum, the Science Museum. I think people now have a large opportunity to go to a museum and to discover a lot of things. And I'm sure that Miami, it's really going to be bigger and bigger in the years to come.
I want to ask you about you. So you're the grandson of one of the most famous 20th century artists, and probably maybe just one of the most famous artists ever. Your grandmother, it was Marie-Thérèse Walter,
yes,
who was his partner for many years. You never met him.
Oh, I was too young.
Yeah.
In fact, I was a boy, and my mother, the daughter of Pablo and Marie-Thérèse, wanted to protect us, myself, my brother, and my sister. Not even my sister, she was not born at that time, but there were rumors about people being refused at the gate, and she didn't want to face this. Of course, she was wrong, because the widow of Pablo, Jacqueline, told my mother, never, it will have never happened with you. But my mother wanted also to protect us from the confusion. Pablo Picasso was extremely famous, rich, and criticized or admired. And at that time, I think that there was no importance for me to have a non-conversation with Pablo Picasso. You know, in the last years, he was totally devoted to his studio. He wanted to paint and draw and do more and do more and do more. And at that time, I was only concerned by school and playing soccer with friends.
But what was it like growing up? And I wondered at what, you know, the different phases of your life, what it's like knowing that, your grandfather is, this iconic figure.
For me, it was normal, because at home we had paintings, drawings, images of my grandfather, my grandmother, my mother. And so everything was normal. It's only the day he died that it was not normal, because I was informed by the television. In fact, a few hours after he died...
That's how you found out?
Yeah.
It was on TV.
It was on TV. So for me, to announce the death of someone on television live was very bizarre. And from that moment and the following weeks, I've been given answers to questions I never wondered about. And from that moment, I knew it was a different life I was going to enter.
You eventually wrote the biography of your grandfather.
In fact, you cannot escape.
In fact,
with Pablo Picasso, you have to live by him, and you don't have a life. You have to live without him, which is quite impossible, because at the moment people will know. Or you have to live with him, which is my decision. So I've studied law. I was very wrong. I was very bad at drawing, so there was no chance for me to become a painter. So I studied law, and I moved into television, into music production, and one day I was asked to write a book, and I thought it was going to be a 3-month job, and in fact it took me 2 years, because it was a passion to discover so much about my grandfather. I was lucky to be inside, and I wanted to give people a different look. I'm not an art historian or journalist, but I think I can add something else to the knowledge of Pablo Picasso.
Yeah, the book, again, Pablo, it's called Picasso, An Intimate Portrait. What did you have to learn about him that you didn't know to be able to put this work together? Because as you said, it took a couple of years to do it.
Yeah, because I wanted to answer rumors and legends about Pablo Picasso. And probably because I studied law, I've been very careful while meeting people, to do interviews, to look at documents, and helped me a lot to set the record straight. First, about his generosity, because there were rumors he was a greedy person and not helping. No, he helped his family, he helped his friends, and he helped people in need, like, for example, during the Second World War or during the Civil War in Spain. And today, with the raffle, I think, in a way, he's helping again people. So, it's quite pleasant to say that Pablo Picasso was not difficult, but it was not easy.
Is that something people get wrong about him? Is the fact that maybe people thought he was greedy or selfish?
Yeah, among other ideas, because Pablo Picasso has been one of the very few artists in the art history to have many periods. By the way, each period, the blue period, pink period, cubist period, surrealist period, was about a woman every time there was an image. He was not an abstract painter. He needed a model. preferably a woman, but maybe a landscape, maybe an object. It was very curious. And there was a misunderstanding because people knew only about the last years, thinking, what is this? A lot of painting, a lot of paint on the canvas. And no, if you look at the beginning, he was painting like the best classical artist, but he wanted to create his own language.
I can attest to that. How, you know, once being an art student, his work changed so much throughout his life. Again, I'm talking with Olivier Picasso, the grandson of the 20th century master Pablo Picasso. He lives here in Miami Beach, but he's also here for a special raffle. You could pay $109 to enter this raffle to win a Picasso painting, and it's going to benefit the nonprofit Care International. That's a group, again, that helps provide access to clean water for 200,000 people throughout Africa. You can find more details on our social media at WLRN Sundial. How have you found your own voice, your own identity, considering, again, you carry this name? And I have to say this because it was so funny. You know, when you arrived, our receptionist downstairs calls up and says, Mr. Picasso is here.
Oh, I agree with you. Yes. Yes, it's... You say in my book and on television documentaries, I've said that it's very easy to be a banker after a banker, to be a journalist after a journalist, but to be Picasso after Picasso is impossible. So it's always bizarre to me because we have one original and we are just the rest of the family. So it gives me a lot of rights, but it gives me also a lot of obligations. So thanks to my parents, my father is a retired Navy officer. So we have been raised in a normal life. How to succeed without Picasso, how to get a result without Picasso. So it helped us. Whatever, then we have the luck of a name, of a patrimony, of a worldwide access to a lot of stuff. But I have to be humble.
I think I read that you, what was it, in the 80s, you decided to take, and I guess under French law, you could take your mother's name, but you took your grandfather's name, too, as well.
In fact, in France, in the mid-80s, a law gave everyone the possibility to have both names, the father's name, Widmayer, and Picasso, my mother's name. And now in France, for example, you have the right to give your children the name of the mother or the father, or both in one direction or the other. So it's very simple. So at some point, I made the record very straight about this. I have a very beautiful ancestor, Pablo Picasso, and I'm bearing his name.
What do you think that he would, how would he feel? And again, you didn't know him, but you wrote the book about him and you've studied his life. How do you think he would view what he has become in our culture, in the world today, as famous as he is? He was already famous when he was alive.
Yeah, but he noticed very early that his talent was not without a consequence. And I think that from the very beginning, he knew that he had to perform a kind of mission. He was not a religious person, even if born in the Spanish Catholic, in the Catholic Spanish country. But to me, it was above the value of artworks, above the success. It was something like a mission. And I discovered that by exploring a conversation he had with people and so on. So the fame has been huge. After the Second World War, he was famous, especially in America, because of the museum, the MoMA in New York, and about the magazines, Life, for example, showing him on the beach with his children, everything. So it was still simple. It was accessible. Today, it will have been more difficult because of the social medias and because of the instant fame of people on television. But when you realize that he died in 1973, there is not a week without anything about Picasso everywhere. An exhibition, a gallery, an auction sales, sometimes a scandal about something, a robbery, or today a raffle. So is very present. I remember I had a conversation with Jeff Koons, one of the major American artists of today, and he told me that he remembers clearly the day Pablo Picasso died. He was impressed to see the New York Times, but also the Pravda in Russia, and everything about those Picasso in the world. And he told me that that day he decided, I want to be Picasso. he became Jeff Koons.
You know, I mean, you think about that, and yeah, and it's you're right. I think in today's world, with how with social media, how things have changed, I always wondered what an artist who is long past would think of, you know, how some of their work is now viewed. And I was, you know, I looked this up. It was what 2013, his piece La Rêve sold for $155 million.
And it's my grandmother.
Yeah. And it's your grandmother. That's a
so for me, it's quite special.
By the way, do you have a Picasso?
You know, it's public. It has been public. So I'm okay to say that. But my grandfather kept a lot of his work. When he died, he has kept something like 2,500 paintings, okay. Okay. 30,000 drawings, over 1,000 sculptures. He was probably anticipating the perfect museum. And part of it, the inheritance taxes, have contributed to create the Museum Picasso in Paris, which is a masterpiece. And you realize that from a house to another house, he was keeping his children, the artworks. And so he was thinking about the fact that his work was also for everybody. So he was thinking about a perfect museum.
One lucky person is going to win this raffle, yep, and have a Picasso. So what advice do you give them about how to appreciate it, what to do with it?
First, if you can, put it in your living room, because there's a difference between seeing a picture of an artwork, and if you have a chance to go to a museum, it's a first step. If you have a chance to have it at home, it's another thing. I am very lucky. I have this chance. So every morning I wake up and I take a coffee in front of a painting. And there is a special connection. And I think whatever you like Picasso, you don't like Picasso, and you like another artist, the connection to go to a museum and to have 30 seconds or a few minutes in front of an artwork is something different. So the lucky winner will have this chance, yes.
By the way, we heard from one of our listeners, Eliana from Miami, called us, and she said that she's getting a tattoo of Picasso's dog, Dotson, and she wants to know more about the dog. So, you know, we've been talking, by the way, with Olivier Picasso. He is the grandson of the 20th century master Pablo Picasso. Again, learn more about the charity raffle benefiting Care International, a chance to win a Pablo Picasso. And again, the charity helping hundreds of thousands of people in Africa to get access to clean, safe water. Mr. Picasso, first of all, I love saying that. Mr. Picasso, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
More to come. We are going to be talking, we're going to take you back to South Beach in the late 80s and early 90s. That is the setting for this month's Sundial Book Club title, Ordinary Girls. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Puerto Rican author Chiquita Diaz's life has been anything but ordinary. From the early years growing up in government housing in Puerto Rico to struggling through the kind of poverty on Miami Beach that she described as the kind of poor you felt in your bones, Diaz felt torn by life. She had a father who was practically absent and a mother diagnosed with schizophrenia who regularly kidnapped her own children. As a teen, she battled substance abuse and took numerous trips in the back of police cars. But eventually, Diaz found herself and the confidence to come out. Ordinary Girls is her coming-of-age story, and it's the March title for the Sundial Book Club. We talked to Diaz, and by the way, you can join the book club, find us on Facebook, and read along with us. Let's go to that conversation.
You grew up in Puerto Rico, but your childhood is not painted by some beautiful, lush, tropical place.
No.
You grew up in government housing in a tough neighborhood. Take me back to those early years. What was that like for you?
Those early years in El Caserío Padre Rivera, it was a government housing project where everybody was poor, working class. There were a lot of young families, a lot of elderly retirees. What everyone had in common is that they were poor and we lived in government housing. But also it felt very much like a community. I mean, there was a lot of crime. There were a lot of drug dealers. It was also the 80s where everybody all over the island, all over Miami was dealing cocaine. There was a huge drug war. There were cops coming in and raiding places for drugs and guns. That, in our lives, was normal. But it was also a place that felt, like I said, very much like a community where kids were always playing out in the street. Everybody's mothers or grandmothers were looking out for us. We all walked to school together. They had Halloween parties in the neighborhood. In a lot of ways, it felt like safe. Like, I wasn't really aware of the danger. And so when cops would come in and raid places, or when there was a shootout or a fight or something, that seemed like it was okay. It came with, you know, all these other things, a sense of community. It's much later, after I was a grown woman, that I realized how violent it really was, how like violence even found its way into our childhood games.
Tell me a little bit about grandmothers, Abuela and Mercy. Very different people.
Yes, absolutely. Well, my father's family is Black. My mother's family is white, all Puerto Rican. And I was raised mostly by my Black grandmother, my father's mother, who was very loving and uplifting. And she was a devout Catholic. She always let us know she loved us. She raised my brother. She started raising my brother first when my mother started showing symptoms of mental illness. She was a calm presence. She was very positive. And she never really cared for white people's standards of beauty. She was very proud of her Blackness and affirmed that in us. And always, you know, let us know that we were a Black family. In her house, she always called us mi negrita, mi negrito. And that to her was, they were terms of endearment, and it was positive. And so from her, we learned to love our Blackness, to love our family, to love the part of us that to everyone else in my mother's family, specifically my mother's mother, to her, everything that to her was negative.
Mercy.
Mercy. Yeah. Mercy was, she was racist, to put it mildly. She was not very positive. She was very abusive to my mother and her other daughters, also suffered from mental illness, and never really let us forget that we would never look like her. My sister and I look brown. My brother is white passing, but she never let us forget that we would never look like her white family. And she never missed a chance to remind us and to blame my father's family for things that went wrong in my mom's life.
I thought about, like, my favorite part was the, you know, she'd give you haircuts.
Yes, she did.
And then she'd always talk about bad hair, your hair.
Yes.
And that's how where the racism was coming through.
Yeah, yeah. That's mostly how she showed it. So she trained as a hairdresser for a while, and she gave us haircuts, my sister and I, but most often me. And so she would cut off all my hair. And I did write about this in the book. And she would say it wasn't that I got a bad haircut. She gave me a fine haircut. It was my bad hair, and that I had hair like my father's. Whereas my Black grandmother, to her, she always said, you're beautiful, your hair is beautiful, your sister's beautiful, you're all beautiful.
So growing up in that,
mm-hmm.
I mean, tell me a little bit about, you know, as a child, on one side, you're hearing, you're being told, be proud of what you are,
mm-hmm.
you're beautiful. On the other side, you know, your grandmother's chopping your hair off, she's telling you're ugly because you'll never be like me.
Yeah. And more than that, she made up these stories about how the Black people in her family couldn't be trusted, how Black people would put a curse on us, how we needed to be afraid of our own grandmother, of Abuela and her family. Like, this was a daily occurrence with her. So in a lot of ways, she frightened me. She frightened all of us. My cousins also have a Black father, and she gave them the same kind of hell. The four of us, we often talked about how if she died, we wouldn't really grieve her. And then she did. She died by suicide. And then we spent a long time talking about whether or not what we were experiencing was grief or shock. It took me a very long time to realize that I was experiencing grief, because I had, when my abuela died, my Black grandmother, it destroyed me. I thought I lost my connection to the world, to happiness, to my Blackness, to Puerto Rico. It shattered me. But when Mercy died, I thought, what am I even feeling? Is this grief? I don't even know if I can grieve or if I'm allowed to grieve.
Eventually, you and your family leave Puerto Rico. You come to Miami Beach.
Mm-hmm.
This is the mid-80s, right?
Yes, 1987.
You're living in the beach. This is a very different time. Miami Beach, to those who were not here, more violent, a lot different, not the image that we have, that we see every day. One story that you highlighted, this was interesting, was that of Lazaro Figueroa, the lollipop baby.
Mm.
And I wondered why you wanted to touch on this crime. It's kind of this thread under the story for a while.
I found out about Baby Lollipops, which is what they called him. His name was Lazaro Figueroa. when I was a kid watching the news, and they showed his picture on the news, and they said they had found the body of this baby. And at the time, I kind of already imagined myself a writer. And I followed this story with the obsession of a journalist, but also not even realizing that that's what I was doing. I followed the story because this happened in my neighborhood, or right very close to our neighborhood in Miami Beach, because everyone was talking about it. It was on all the newspapers, on the news all the time. They had, I mean, Boy Scouts passing out flyers, asking about, do you know the identity of this baby? In a lot of ways, so I was like a budding writer thinking about this as a journalist. But at the same time, it was really about what was happening with me personally. At around the same time, my mother took my sister and I from my father, who was a custodial parent, and she was in the throes of schizophrenia and was often violent and sometimes unpredictable. And so I was very scared of her. And
she once came in the middle of the night, took you from your house.
Yes, yes.
Pack your stuff, let's go.
And she took us. And she did this after that. She did it two more times. But I was terrified of my mother. And then the news aired. And then we found out that it was his mother who killed him. So somehow in my mind, I connected those two things. I thought my mother could be this violent, even though she actually wasn't that violent. She had moments when she became abusive, when she was in the middle of a breakdown, but she was mostly okay. She was very neglectful, but I was terrified of my mother. But then there was also this other aspect to the case, which is how people in the neighborhood, in the community, on the news talked about his mother, Ana Maria Cardona, and how they referred to her so often as the lesbian mother, and referred to her relationship with another woman who was also a suspect, who was also arrested and convicted of the crime, and how they talked about them. And they made it sound very much like being a lesbian or being gay was part of the crime. Like that was just as bad as torturing and killing your baby, being gay. And I was a closeted queer kid growing up in Miami Beach, which later became kind of like a gay mecca, but also there were a lot of gay people in Miami Beach back then. There were so many gay people. And there were also so many gay people who were victims of violence. And I saw this and I knew about this. So it felt to me like I needed to hide who I was, that it was dangerous to be who I was.
I'm speaking with author Chiquita Diaz. She was born in Puerto Rico and moved to Miami Beach at a young age and was raised here. She currently lives in Miami Beach, and she tells her story in a memoir titled Ordinary Girls. It's this month's Sundial Book Club pick. And by the way, you can join the Sundial Book Club on Facebook and read along with us. So, Chiquita, you're going to read this one segment for us. And this is where you and your family leave Puerto Rico and you start your new life in Miami.
Yes. This is from Home is a Place. We left Puerto Rico that summer after Papi came back home one night, and both he and Mommy acted as if he'd never left. We still didn't know everything we would lose. The Sebas, the Flamboyanes, the Moribibi, the Coquis singing us to sleep at night. Everything we'd already lost. We wouldn't know it until it was too late. We arrived in Miami Beach. Papi, Mommy, Abuela, Anthony, Elena, and me, our parents back together for the last time. We stayed in a hotel in South Beach until we found an apartment on West Avenue. Anthony and I started a new school where we would be stripped of our language, where we wouldn't be allowed a hall pass to the bathroom unless we could ask in English, where boys ignored me and I ignored boys, where girls asked, like I knew they would, "Why do you look like a boy?" We walked the 9 or 10 blocks home from school alone, cutting through Flamingo Park, where I sometimes stopped to sit in the swings or watch the high school guys play ball. We would move like 6 times that first year, and our parents would not stop fighting, and every new apartment would be smaller than the last. Eventually, we would run out of money, and Papi would work 2 jobs 7 days a week to make ends meet, barely managing to support our family. Papi would leave Mommy again after one of their screaming matches turned into a fight, that ended with Mommy knocking him unconscious.
When you were a child, at what point did you understand about what was happening to your mother. And when was she diagnosed?
She was diagnosed after we came to Miami Beach. I think I was 8 or 9 years old after we moved from Puerto Rico.
And at that age, did you comprehend what that meant?
No. She had started showing symptoms years before, talking about a man who was following her and someone who was stalking her. And I didn't really understand what that meant. I thought there was a man stalking her. I really did. And I looked for him everywhere, and I was looking out for a stalker. My mother would say, there's someone outside trying to get in the house. And I believed her. I thought, there's a man outside trying to get in the house. And then after we moved to Miami Beach, I realized that she saw a man and heard a man, and I didn't see or hear anything, and that she started talking to herself and laughing by herself. And it happened in short bursts of awareness rather than all at once. I realized my mother is laughing by herself. My mother is hearing voices. And then I would kind of block that out and try not to think about it because it was terrifying. But I think I finally had a full understanding of it when she got the diagnosis and she was hospitalized for the first time. I realized, okay, this is real. And I kind of just had to accept it because I couldn't do anything about it.
Did that change the way you viewed her? Because there was so much resentment mm-hmm. as to what she was doing to you mm-hmm. and your sister. But after knowing that, did that change the way you viewed her?
No, it actually made it worse. I didn't understand this at the time. I had no language for it. But I thought it was something that could happen to me because my grandmother, Mercy, suffered from the same thing. She took medication, and then my mother suffered from it. She took medication. And I thought, this is something that could and probably will happen to me. And so I resented her even more. I had no understanding of it. And it was terrifying. It was my greatest fear that I would end up like my mom and Mercy. It wasn't until I left Miami and I went into the military that I thought, where no one knew me, that I thought, oh, I can finally be myself in a way for a moment, and then decided, no, this also can't happen.
So it was not easy to open up to the world, even today, and to be as transparent as you've been in this book, but why did you feel eventually like you had to open up and tell this story?
I remember being a college kid, being 19 after leaving the military. And I was a kid who loved books and always went to the library and asked the librarian to give me books. And I was always reading. And I remember the moment when I found Esmeralda Santiago's When I Was Puerto Rican, a memoir about her growing up in Puerto Rico and moving to New York. And it was the first time that I saw someone who was Puerto Rican writing about their life in English. And I thought, oh my God, we exist. You can write about us. You can do this. And it felt like something changed for me right away when I saw myself in a book. Even though Esmeralda Santiago's life was very different from mine, even though in many ways she was like a good girl and I was this lost juvenile delinquent, I thought, I want this for myself. I want to do this. And it was important to me to reach out to girls who were like I was, who had never seen themselves in books, and to write about people like me. And so I decided that when I became a writer, I would write about people like me, people who were Puerto Rican, people who were Black and brown, who had grown up in poverty, who were from working class families, who came from the El Caserío and who had grown up in Miami Beach, because we never see ourselves in books.
For me, reading this book is kind of almost like I'm reading this like day-to-day diary of this young woman and, you know, her journey through life. And as she's going through all of these experiences, she's changing, and she reaches that, the teenage years. She becomes angry and resentful, lashing out at that world. And then you come to find yourself and an understanding of yourself. Mm-hmm. What is it you wanted us to take away from your story?
Well, when I first started writing this book, I struggled with whether I should write it as memoir or as a novel. I had a really difficult time accepting who I was in a lot of ways because I was queer, I was gay, and I was closeted. So that was something that I wasn't really willing to disclose to my family at the time, even though I was open with my friends professionally, I was. But it was really scary to me to possibly ever come out to my family. But also, there were other, like, there were things I had done that I didn't really know if I could own up to in a way, like, accept that I had been this awful person, that I had been violent and angry. And then I realized, I mean, I made it. I'm now a writer. I am a teacher, an editor. So in a lot of ways, it felt like, not that I wanted my story to be inspirational, but it was important to me to write something that was important to other, to readers, to girls who are now like I was, and to young women who maybe didn't see themselves in books growing up. And I thought of myself as a young reader and how important it would have been to me to pick up a book that had characters like me, characters who grew up in poverty or in working class neighborhoods or who had mothers with mental illness. And I thought, I need to tell the truth.
That was Jaquita Diaz, author of Ordinary Girls, a memoir. It's this month's Sundial Book Club selection. Remember, find us on Facebook, join the book club. We'd love to have you. Well, that's Sundial for this Tuesday, March 10th. Coming up tomorrow on the program, how is tourism in Miami-Dade and South Florida going to be affected by this ongoing concern of COVID-19? We're going to be speaking with one of the leaders of the Greater Miami Visitors Convention Bureau. Also, it's termite season, so get ready. We'll let you know what's happening and what you need to know to protect your home. And a discussion about the Miami Film Festival. All of that coming up tomorrow on the program. Remember, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Sundial, WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.